In an area like ours, where downtown and country are just minutes apart, we notice farms. We notice in particular when they disappear, and last year's rows of hay bales become this year's rows of suburban houses. But as long as all of us continue to need to eat, we'll still need farms, and many programs are arrayed to help farms stay in business, while a bunch of other programs preserve the history of farming in our region. Our next guest is connected to several such programs. Maureen Flanagan Battistella is an assistant professor of sociology and anthropology at Southern Oregon University, where she's an affiliate researcher and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Maureen, thanks for joining us here.
Thanks for having me.
When I look at the list of programs that you're involved with, and we're talking about the Century Farm Program, there's a wine collection at the library, there's the Landscape Gained, Landscape Lost, Landscape Changed Project, and that's not the whole list for you. I mean, I have to ask first if you grew up on a farm or if all this interest came to you later in life.
Well, that's a great place to start. I actually grew up in New Jersey.
So, likely not.
Yeah, Jersey Shore, Sopranos, all that was certainly part of my heritage, though I never had the big hair. However, there was farming in my background, and Jersey is the Garden State. South Jersey is primarily agriculture. My aunt and uncle had a farm that in a couple of years will be a Century Farm. Multi-generational. My cousins have lived on that ground and raised tomatoes and corn for their community and for the greater area of southern New Jersey.
People forget sometimes that once you get a few miles away from the Interstate 95 corridor on the East Coast, there is lots of open land, lots of open country, lots of farming going on.
Exactly. We moved from there to Nebraska and South Dakota, where I saw in Nebraska corporate farms, huge corporate farms right down the block from where we lived, poisoning all the trees that were kind of along our street. And from there, South Dakota, which is primarily family farms. So it was a really good background, agricultural background, just observing the different kinds of agriculture that was around there and how difficult agriculture as an industry and as an occupation could be.
You know, we talk to enough people involved in agriculture on the exchange. We get a real feel for that. Mm-hmm. One of the things that gets mentioned the most that always comes back to me is like, unlike anybody who runs a factory, you don't know what your final production is going to be at the end of the season.
Yeah, that's true. And in South Dakota and Nebraska, I could see that families were taking on debt of $100,000 a year in order to seed their ground in anticipation of who knew what. Weather, pests, any of those things could cause disaster in their family. So it's a real amazing thing to come here and understand heritage agriculture and to see multi-generational families farming the same land for 100 years.
So is that the common thread, is the continuity from generation to generation in agriculture a common thread among all the projects you're working on?
Yes, I would say so. I think the multi-generational attachment to the land, how the land is related to their family, to their culture, their personal history is that common thread.
Do you specialize in looking at certain kinds of agricultural products? I know you're well-versed in cheese, but I know this from having met you off the program as well.
Yeah. I guess my first interest here when we moved to Southern Oregon was in grapes. I met Will Brown, who's a local wine historian. At 75, he decided he wanted to learn more about the making of wine, became a cellar rat, which at 75 is kind of an amazing thing. You're going into tanks and pulling hoses and shifting barrels. So he and I really in the year 2000 went about to probably seven or 12 different wineries and spent a lot of time with the wine growers and winemakers. It was an experience.
So, and he's been at it for a long time, though. He's been involved in the wine business for decades now, it sounds like.
He is. He has a remarkable relationship with the growers and winemakers here in Southern Oregon. He's done oral histories of really many of the earliest grape growers. The grape growing here, everybody knows, kind of started with Peter Britt, but went away for a long time and kind of resurged in the 70s. And he's got oral histories and documents that relate to those first grape growers here in Southern Oregon in the 70s. My work is taking it forward a little bit more. I'm looking at issues of sustainability, definitely relationship to multi-generational succession issues. I'm looking at branding, issues like labor and economics. So it's been a beautiful complement to Will's earlier work.
The reason I was asking specifically about how long wine has been grown in the Rogue Valley is because even casual observers notice over the recent decade and a half or so that a number of orchards where there used to be rows of pear trees, the pear trees knocked over a few years ago by bulldozer and then replaced by vineyards.
Yes.
And so a large transition that appears to be still underway.
Yes. The whole pears to grape transition in the valley is just remarkable. Some of the vineyards that formerly were orchards were Hillcrest out in Medford, Del Rio up Gold Beach, or Gold Hill, sorry. I do want a vacation.
Right. Someplace gold.
Yeah. And Dunbar Farms is another. They were formerly orchards and now have grapes, among other things. And that's not the first agricultural transition the valley has had. We went from pears to grapes, and that understanding of transition for me led me back to see where pears came from. We used to have a lot of apples here in the 1800s, and when the railroad came, and particularly this guy Joseph Stewart came in 1883, we started getting pears. But pears took a while to kind of come into play, and we did have a more diversified agricultural base at that time. We had more hay, more dairy, more truck crops, and really the extension service over at Southern Oregon Extension in Central Point has their eye on all of these transitions. They know not only through the USDA agricultural census, but through their daily work with growers, how many acres are moving from one crop to another.
Really? Oh, they really track it that closely. Mm-hmm. Maureen Flanagan Battistella is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, researcher at Southern Oregon University, looking into the history of agriculture in the Rogue Valley and across Southern Oregon. Join us on the Exchange. Maybe you have a couple of stories about farming in the region yourself that go back a couple of decades that you'd like to tell us about, or some questions you have for Maureen. 800-838-3760 to get into the conversation by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. It's funny you mentioned the different crops, because just this morning in the 100 years ago today in the Mail Tribune column in the Medford paper, there was a discussion about how broccoli can be a great thing to grow around here too. So it seems like everything got tried at least once.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the credits of the Extension Service. They've really done a lot of research in a variety of crops, worked closely with farmers. Some stories that I've heard, Otto Bonnard out in Central Point was a premier farmer, so willing to try different crops, different species and varietals on his land. John Jungen is one of the catalogers personalities that have been around. John Jungen was the former director at SOREC. He's been actually coming to work every day since 1950.
Wow.
1950, comes to work every day. So I spent a couple of hours talking with him about the changes he'd seen here in the valley. He asked me to bring donuts one time. He said they were so good.
A cultural product, yeah.
Yeah, he said they were so good he might start having donuts now in the morning.
Wow. No reason to change his routine now.
This is
1950. So, God, so many ways that you're involved in things that track agricultural history. First of all, there's this whole looking backward effect, I think, where people who are not involved in agriculture assume that things stayed the same way for decades, if not centuries. But the fact is, it sounds like it's been constant churn, constant looking for crops that would work.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think the other thing that's happened is that Oregon in particular took a leadership role in land use legislation. Tom McCall in the 70s worked with communities and counties throughout the state to identify and protect lands that were suitable for agriculture. One of the interesting things about that was that some of the land deemed unsuitable for agriculture in the Willamette actually was best suited for grapes. And so some of that land had to be reclassified or classified for a different use than might have been. Here in Southern Oregon, agricultural properties within urban growth boundaries really quickly got snapped up. But we're still seeing some encroachment on agricultural properties. In Central Point, for example, the Beebe Farm, run by Dino Piccolo, that's Ken Beebe's property. And even today, housing developments are encroaching on that ground and using the groundwater that would have irrigated that farm. So there are many challenges.
And I noticed recently there was a discussion of adjusting Medford's urban growth boundary and city limits, which would potentially annex Hillcrest, what was Hillcrest Farms and Hillcrest Orchards, now Hillcrest Vineyards, into the city.
Yes, yes. And Dunbar Farms is right over there as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of very rich agricultural property. And I think the owners of these properties have to be very vigilant and very passionate about their own attachment to the land. That's some of the stories that we've been turning up. Particularly, this might be too early in the conversation to talk about, but this Sunday we're going on a heritage orchard tour. Mm-hmm. Where the Southern Oregon Historical Society has organized a tour of 10 heritage orchards around the valley.
Is this the Miles Through History program?
Miles Through History. Mm-hmm. And Dunbar Farms and Hillcrest will be one of them. Judd Parsons will be there. So Judd has protected a lot of his land through conservancy easements. Mm-hmm. And also through a family trust that governs the heritage properties in the family. And so there are different mechanisms that heritage property owners can use to protect their property from encroaching urban growth boundaries.
We're talking about the changing nature of agriculture across the region with Maureen Flanagan Battistella, who is a researcher at Southern Oregon University in sociology and anthropology, connected to a number of different projects, including the Miles Through History program you just heard about coming up Sunday. We'll get further details on that. We'd like to hear from you if you have stories to tell about agriculture in your family. Maybe you are a farmer yourself and can talk about the way things have changed over the years. 800-838-3760 on the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So what we were just talking about seems to dovetail into this other thing you're working on called the Landscape Gained, Landscape Lost, Landscape Changed Project.
Yeah, that's a small research project that's been funded by the Oregon Heritage Commission. It's running this year and next year. We've identified through this project four different groups that we are interested in understanding not only their methods and processes, but their factors, the criteria for longevity. We're looking at 10 century farms, five of which are still in the family, five century farms that are no longer in the family. The lands have been lost to other purposes. We're looking at 10 family farms, multi-generational family farms, and those would include families like Dalton Strauss, John Bingham, John Bonnert, Patsy Edward. We're also looking at newer agriculturalists such as Steve Fry and others who are newer to the valley. But
that's Fry Family Farm.
Fry
mm-hmm.
Family Farms, right. They're taking a real amazing leadership role in kind of ensuring the food supply for Southern Oregon, but also helping to develop new markets. I'm seeing collaboration among the farmers today. People talking about issues, talking about opportunities that is unique and very positive.
When you talk about the century farms, these are farms that have been farmed for 100 years or more, and some are still in the same hands. Are they more focused in any one corner of the state than any other?
that's an interesting question, and it may be more political than anything. But I think the agricultural properties to the north, Willamette, and further north get more attention to those in the south. Century farms are farms that have been in one family and in production for over 100 years. Here in Southern Oregon, there are 100 century farms. And today what we're looking at is how many of those 100-year farms are still in existence. There really aren't that many when you come down to it. Because if you think about it, the rich agricultural properties here in Ashland, for example, Talent, Phoenix, and Medford, those properties were also conducive to development and within urban growth boundaries.
But I wonder, based on what you were saying before about Oregon's land use planning, and in fact, it was just a couple of weeks ago, we actually played the bit of Tom McCall's speech where he talked about coastal condomania,
yeah,
which led to Senate Bill 100 and the formation of the Land Conservation and Development Commission and all of that. So centralized land use planning, trying to make sure that lands that are good as forests and good as farms stay in those capacities. For that reason, then, does it appear that Oregon has a better record of keeping farmland as farmland than some other states?
Oregon is certainly the leader in land use planning for a couple of reasons, both because it's grassroots. It worked with the people, very contentious, troubled times to work out these policies. And there are still a lot of watchdog agencies in place. 100,000 Friends of Oregon, for example, Greg Holmes, is very alert to any challenge. Even ODOT, I learned yesterday, ODOT has a planner whose specialty is protecting heritage properties.
Really?
Yeah, you wouldn't expect that. But, you know, our state has honored heritage agriculture in many ways, and it's been wonderful to find out about them.
Well, one of the other things that you're involved with, and again, this is such a long list here, but it's the wine collection at the library. And I think you started to touch on some of this a little bit ago.
Yeah.
But the Hannon Library at Southern Oregon University has a collection of artifacts related to the wine industry.
Yep.
Going back quite a few decades, it sounds like.
Yep. That collection was started by Will Brown. Will Brown gave a collection of ephemera and a wine library to Hannon Library. And the library, Mary Jane Cedarface, is really astute and very practical in this matter. She convened further outreach in the region with the help of a grant from the Erath Family Foundation. So over the course of 2 or 3 years, 2013, 2014, through this project, we were able to document about 76 wineries here in Southern Oregon and to gain the oral histories about 50 grape growers and winemakers here in Southern Oregon. Right now, that collection has over 700 specific artifacts relating to wine here in Southern Oregon. Some of the we found some interesting stories through the project that are not well known. Did you know that we found a record of grapes grown here in Jackson County in 1952? Uh-oh. Most of those were Eastern varieties. Many of the grapes were made into wine, but it wasn't production. It wasn't commercial. It was home use. That was interesting because everyone thought that there weren't any grapes here until 1970, right. But there really were. One of the most fascinating things I think we found was Porter Lombard, whom everyone knows, but everyone may not know that when he came and saw that we needed to diversify agriculture, he started planting grape varietals at the Extension Center. And when he became public with his interest in grapes, the pear growers didn't like it.
Really? So there was a backlash from the pear industry.
Tremendous.
From the get-go.
Hmm. They wanted all of the attention on pears at that time. So Porter was actually moved to the Willamette. And the new director, Phil Van Buskirk, who's retiring this year after many years of service, had to do the work on grapes on his own time, nights and weekends.
sounds almost like, you know, it was dark at the night working on the grapes sort of thing.
And I always wondered with Porter going to the Willamette, how did Porter's energy and vision and expertise kind of further the Willamette's grape production? You know, mm-hmm. What would have happened if he stayed here?
Oh, that's an interesting thing to bring up.
Yeah.
How much of what you do is affected by the fact that a lot of the history seems to be stored in heads? Is there as good a paper trail as you wish there were?
Oh, that's thank you for that question. Yeah, it's really curious. Right now, I think we know more about the heritage agriculture in 1880 than we do about farms from the 1950 through 2000. The paper record really was lost for a lot of people between that time because of death, family succession, you know, change of use, just disregard. It's kind of a generational thing.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the projects that we're working on, the Landscape Changed Project, really does seek out these memories, seek out these artifacts, seek out photographs and documents and deeds and letters and stories of people before we want to capture these stories before they pass. We've got two students working on the project, two bright students, Alessandra de, Alessandra De La Torres and Kate Hillis. They're tracking down, they're doing property tracing for all these farms, and they're doing genealogy tracings for all these farms. And the next step will be to interview the farmers.
Sounds fun. Grab the headphones. We have a call for you. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange to Tony and Talent. We're talking to Maureen Battistella. Welcome, Tony.
Good morning. Yes. I heard, actually, I think it's on this program, not with you, Jeff, but probably the previous Jeff, but I think it was a local grape grower, the amount of wine produced or the number of vineyards existing before Prohibition in this area was equal to the amount of grape, either the wine production now or the number of vineyards now. Now, this was a few years ago, so I suspect that's an old statistic that's been exceeded because we've sort of proliferated, but... is that true, that prior to Prohibition, this was a very thriving grape-growing area?
Well, let's find out. Thanks, Tony.
You know, I'm not sure I can answer that question. I would suspect not. I would suspect that most of the agriculture, looking at what we know from the agricultural census and the work that the Southern Oregon Research and Extension Bureau has done, really leads us to understand that more of the land was in seed crops, in field crops such as hay or alfalfa. Dairy was huge in Southern Oregon, taking up many acres, and pears, really.
So if people want to do the farm tour on Sunday, the Miles Through History tour, how do they get involved in that?
Okay. Go to Southern Oregon Historical Society's website, www.sohs.org. Sign up online. We've only got a limit of 12 cars.
Okay. A wealth of history going on history exploration going on in agriculture. Maureen Battistella, connected to a lot of us. Thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
It's been a pleasure.
All right. Take care.